It's Greg here. Due to the fact I'm travelling to Sacramento this weekend to attend HP's Network Tech Day and Ethan and Dan have other commitments, we recorded a bumper double show last week and to be released in two parts. And therefore, this is part two of Big, Hot and Heavy Switches. Part one was last week. On the show this week, we have Ethan, Jeremy Philibin from jeremyphilibin.com, Steve Rossen, who is at Steve on Twitter, Dan Hughes, Ivan Pepelniak of ioshints.info, and myself. Here we go, part two. Oh, and I almost forgot to tell you, Ivan Pepelniak and myself have joined together for a Meet the Author event in San Jose on September 15. Ivan, of course, is the well-known blogger at ioshints.info and the author of many Cisco Press textbooks and well-known for his deep technical knowledge. And I'll be turning up to provide advice on server and storage networking and provide my own unique critical viewpoint on vendor technologies. With a strictly limited number of seats, we can meet you in an open room format to discuss data center networking design and implementation in a very small group. Bring your designs, questions and topics for us to discuss, analyze, whiteboard and provide feedback in a 3-hour session. You can find more information at http://ioshintsdatacenter.eventbrite.com, and that URL is in the show notes. On with the show. It's time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
Where too much networking would never be enough.
A podcast on the data networking industry. Routing, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Are you ready? One of the things that Jeremy raised in the show notes was that talking about the proliferation of 10 gigabit attached user devices pushing the need for higher density. Jeremy, why don't you lead us out on what your thrust is with that point?
Yeah, I can go over my story. So last year, or actually about a year and a half ago, we started planning to build a new data center. And, I thought this was the time to put 10 gig in, and went to my data center teams and server teams and said, what do you need for 10 gig? We're ready to go. And I think they totaled up to a grand total of maybe 12 or 15 ports. They just didn't have the interest at the time, even for the Sandhead end gear. They just didn't have the interest. So we built that data center. It's Nexus based, and it's, the faxes, and I've described it a bit here, a few thousand ports. It turns out this coming year we're building another new data center. And I went back around and did the same exercise, and the total I got was about 750 10 gig ports. So, 18 months later, and the demand is just astronomical. So I kind of wonder why. A lot of those ports are either SAN related or HP. We use a lot of HP C-class chassis. They want to do a lot of 10 gig out of those chassis, and there's dozens and dozens of chassis that are going to be bought for this new project. So
SAN related, are you talking NAS heads for something presenting SIFS or NFS, or are you talking like FCOE?
No, SIFS, NFS, iSCSI even, not FCOE. We have I got some meetings next week where I'm going to lobby very hard to not put any fiber channel in the new data center. We'll see if I get my way, but
that's a good decision, Jeremy.
Oh, I really hope I win. So,
I think that the interesting part about 10 gig is that we're seeing the server manufacturers adopt 10 gig. So 2 years ago, they sort of went, yeah, but nobody's even driving 1 gig. And the server manufacturers are now being driven by VMware. And 2 years ago, we were putting 2 to 5 servers per VMware instantiation. Now people are running 25 VMware. Guest operating systems on VMware and reaching up to sort of 40 or 50. So if you've got 20 servers sharing a 1 gigabit line, you would have practical concerns around, would 1 gig be enough? Would 4 gigs be enough if you took 4 1 gigs coming out the back? And I've seen C-class implementations where people have had 16 cables coming out the back of the chassis, 4x4 gigabit fiber channels and 8x1 gigs bonded up into an 8 gigabit ether channel. And then they have the 2 ILO cards and some other out of band management stuff. And, you had this festoon of cables coming out the back of a C-class, whereas 10 gig offers us the ability to just plug in 2x10, 10 to each side, and you can have 8 C-class blades, and each one's got 20. So 160 servers sharing a 10-gig line doesn't sound as scary as, you know, sharing a 4-gig Ether channel or an 8-gig Ether channel. And the other thing I think which has driven it is the HP Flex 10 module, which is, I'm not a believer in the Flex 10. Anybody else used got C-classes with HP pushing their Flex 10 wheelbarrow out?
Well, that's the second part of my meetings next week, is determining whether we're going to use pass-through modules or Flex 10 or you know, something else. That I don't think there really is something else, but we'll see what comes up in the discussion. We have a few instances of Flex 10 in our network, but I'm not terribly impressed with it. So my gut tells me, you know, let's do some pass-through modules and plug all these ports directly into the Cisco-based network, and we can manage it a little better.
Steve, have you worked with?
We have quite a few of the C-class chassis. We've talked about the Flex 10. We've looked at them, and we just don't like what we're seeing on them.
What about your server guys? So I mean, networking people don't. Nobody I know who's a networking person likes the Flex 10 technology. It doesn't make sense to us. But the server people I've spoken to treat it like.
Help me out, because I've seen C-class chassis and worked with the virtual connect module they put on. You guys are talking about Flex 10, which you know, I missed that news flash. What is in the Flex 10 that you guys are seeing and do not like?
So the way the Flex 10 works, and somebody correct me if I'm off base here, but it presents a 10 gig port to each server, so each server within the chassis, and then it has up to 8 10 gig uplinks back to the network. So it has 8 physical ports and 16, you know, downstream ports towards the servers. I think the normal implementation would be to put 2 Flex 10 modules into each chassis. So if you have 16 servers, each one gets 2 10 gig ports, and then you have a total of 16 physical cables that can come out of that box up to the network. Kind of the big issue for me is my understanding is that only 8 of the 16 physical cables that come out of that chassis can be active at any one time. So we're burning up 8 10 gig ports and not getting anything for them but backup. And then the other issue is price. You know, they're 2.5 times as expensive as putting a pass-through module in.
It's got a switching fabric and a backplane, but it's able to route fiber channel frames as well as IP packets, as well as Ethernet frames. So it can actually move all of those across a single unified sort of a switching backplane. And the Flex 10 allows you to present 4 gig fiber channel, 8 gig fiber channel in different combination. It allows you to present Ethernet, 1 gig, 10 gig, and you actually slot home various things. However, the Flex 10 is a very old architecture. It was built about 10 years ago, or designed 20, built 10, and it's got all these arbitrary switching. You've got these daughter boards which activate it for this slot and that slot, and once those physical daughter boards have been locked in, then the C-class blades work in certain ways or in certain modes, and there's mezzanine boards and all this sort of stuff. And if you have 100 of them together and you're trying to migrate a VMware server from one C-class chassis to another C-class chassis, and you want the networking interface to stay the same, so the MAC address to be portable between those two chassis, you actually have a great deal of challenges, because the C-class modules have this management license that you have to buy that allows them to transport their settings between servers. And I'm not real strong on this, because we looked into it and then threw them out because of the challenges with trying to bring them into one welded, consolidated thing. But there is, I believe, since then, they may have changed their licensing strategy such that you can buy an additional license and an additional piece of software which allows you to be migrating a blade from one place to another place, and the settings go with it. Does that give you an insight, Ethan?
Yeah, it does. It's a different model than what the Virtual Connect stuff was doing. I mean, there's similarities, but the Virtual Connect sounds like it's a different way that HP was doing things, for sure. So in Flex 10, I just hadn't been on a buy where that was on the table as something for consideration. So
there's a white paper put out by HP, which is called HP Virtual Connect for Cisco people or Cisco engineers or something like that, and it puts the case for Virtual Connect in terms of language that Cisco engineers can talk about, and you can read and try and make sense of it. There's also a thing called HP Virtual Connect for Dummies, although I challenge you to read that and make any sense out of it all. And there's also some very good blog posts where the Cisco UCS engineers throw rotten tomatoes at the HP Flex 10 people, and the HP Flex 10 lob right back with some rotten oranges and some stinky apples. It's a lovely debate, and it goes on and on and on. But for networking people, the greatest thing I find is a loss of control at the networking layer. Once the Flex 10 gets in there, there's like this festering thing at the end of that 10 gig cable that you've got no control over. And the only person who can configure it is a server guy. And I have no idea what's happening once I lose that control.
I've spent many a long hour on the phone with a server guy who was administering a Blade chassis and needed assistance getting the networking bit to work because they don't speak the language of VLANs and .1Q being the most fundamental things that they need to understand that can be challenging if they don't know what they're looking at. And then, right, you were talking about a white paper where they translate HP Virtual Connect stuff into a Cisco language, and then you can kind of make sense out of what it is that HP is doing and help the server admin get things set up. But a lot of times it's anything but straightforward.
This is a great point to introduce our sponsor for the show, Ascolta Training. Ascolta Training is an award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner in the United States who offers an array of Cisco Advanced courses addressing multiple technologies. Using authorized Cisco course material with strong customer focus, they provide top-notch training solutions and consistently have the highest customer satisfaction ratings. Ascolta provides their training using various delivery methods to easily meet your unique needs across the United States, and in addition to their extensive public class schedule, Ascolta excels at developing and delivering client-specific and customized training to fit your environment. And since they're partners for Cisco course development with well-known and industry-experienced instructors, they deliver public training courses and private on-site training. Ascolta has a training solution for you. Please go out there and help them to support the packet pushers. Reach them on 1-800-297-4294 or find them on the web at www.ascolta.com. They're on Twitter as @Ascolta, who you should follow for technical content and for special offers. Mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you book a class, and you'll receive a $250 discount to get you started. That's Ascolta Training, and they want you to learn something. Continuing on with the show, I want to look at some of the other things about oversubscription models. So Ivan talked earlier about line cards being oversubscribed. What about oversubscription models in the distribution and layers where we have multiple access or distribution layers in the data center uplinking to the core? What sort of oversubscription ratios are we seeing in modern data centers, or are we looking to move away from that?
Greg, the first thing that we've been discussing in the podcast notes was that it really depends on what your environment is. So what we are seeing at our customers is that, yes, they have 1 gig, they have 10 gig links, but those links are really utilized to hundreds of megs. So when you are in that space, the oversubscription doesn't matter that much. It depends on what the application is, because you really have to have, I don't know, I think Dan mentioned either distributed computing, where there's a lot of data being exchanged as the various virtual machines work on the same data set, or you need to have some streaming service. But for the traditional applications, it looks like the storage and the CPU or memory are still the limiting factors, so it's hard to fill the 10 gig pipes.
With some of the new storage technologies coming down the pipe, they can easily run, like, for example, I had a briefing recently from a company called Nimbus Storage, and there was another one, I can't quite remember their name. They actually now producing flash arrays, multi-terabyte flash arrays, with 1 point over a million IOPS possible and able to burn 40 gigabits per second in and out of that storage array. That kind of changes the model. Now, we don't see a lot of that today, but we will in, say, the next 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
kind of touched on it before, but I mean, storage, in my mind, still has to be the one that's going to drive bandwidth. Now, obviously, I'm in a slightly unusual situation that way, but even in an ordinary environment, as we sort of move towards much more iSCSI and you know, potentially 5-channel over Token Ring or whatever based technologies, you're going to, you know, you have to see that a completely different level of bandwidth being driven than typical applications do. I suppose, I mean, there are some other things like sort of VMware Heartbeat or Oracle Heartbeat and this kind of thing, which can be quite heavy. But for me, it has to be storage is the one that's going to really, really kill this stuff.
Well, it's funny you say that. I was having a conversation with our VMware guy today, and he's building some new clusters, and we're discussing the network layout. And you know, he and I agreed that the big driver, what's going to be pushing the most data in and out of that cluster, is iSCSI. That's it. And so we were looking at blades and making sure we're distributing uplinks appropriately so as to minimize oversubscription and so on. And so I would agree. Storage is going to be the big driver.
Storage is the heavy load. But the other load that you need to be looking at with VMware is vMotion. And if you have a system which something like DRS or dynamic load sharing inside of your VMware, you're going to have virtual instantiations migrating around the network. And they are very sensitive to latency changes, and they are peaky bandwidth loads.
Yeah, you talk about a very peaky bandwidth load, though, too. Something that's rarely, I'm kind of imagining you're rarely going to see a vMotion happen. It's going to be a disaster scenario, or it's going to be, hey, maintenance time, let's move these hosts elsewhere.
No, Ethan, the real reason that we see vMotion a lot is, like Greg mentioned, DRS, where VMware does automatic load balancing across the cluster and vMotion happens automatically.
That feature is in new, and it's becoming more popular. So up until now, most server administrators haven't been willing to trust it. So the feature basically works like this. You have a VMware instance. You maybe have 20 servers, and you run them heavily oversubscribed, say 50-1, 40-1. And then one of those servers, or you know, say 3 or 4 servers in that set, suddenly burst up to a very high CPU or very high memory usage. VMware says, okay, well, that physical server is now overloaded. Its resources are exhausted, and it will start vMotioning machines off there to other lightly loaded physical chassis in your VMware cluster. So the loads aren't static, they're fully dynamic, and just roam around the resource.
Oh, that's very interesting. See, I think of that in terms of, you know, coming from a load balancer background, like with an F5 or something, where you could dynamically spin up resources and these kind of things to take care of a load scenario. I didn't know VMware was doing that themselves with an on-the-fly decision.
Ethan, what you're looking at is the large-scale scenario, where you need so much CPU power that you have, you know, bare metal servers. What we have are the scenarios where we have like hundreds of servers running on 4 to 10 physical servers. And yes, they are duplicated for software reasons, so we have load balancers in front of them. But still, each application server would use like maybe 10% of a physical server.
So when a vMotion kicks up then, what you know, we're talking about needing a lot of bandwidth and it having to happen fast. Can we translate that into real world? What's actually getting moved and how fast does it need to get where it's going?
The whole virtual machine is getting moved. So actually the memory is getting moved. The prerequisite is that both source and target physical servers have access to the same storage. So the virtual disk has to be accessed from both ends. VMware slowly starts transferring memory image to the other machine. And once it starts doing that, the machines are synchronized. So whenever something happens on the first machine, it's immediately copied over.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the memory images are in sync, all of a sudden the first machine is, the both machines are sort of like suspended for a second. The first one is disconnected and the second one continues. The time it takes, it really depends on how much bandwidth you have. You can do this on 1 gig links if you wish. It depends on how many hops you have in the middle, so latency is important. And vMotion is pretty robust. So even if it takes a while, it survives.
So if you've got a host running on a VM cluster and he takes up 2 gigabytes worth of memory, let's say, or 4, you've got to take that chunk of memory, that memory footprint that makes up that virtual machine, and move it all, keeping things synced, and then you do this hard cutover. But you've got that, you've got a pretty substantial chunk of data that's got to get moved.
Yeah, you have to move four gigabytes of memory. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
And that's why vMotion, the current arbitrary limit from the VMware design guides talks about a 50 millisecond latency maximum. Now, keep in mind here, there's a few different things impacting on the network. If you move a VMware load from, say, your left side of your data center to your right, and physically you're moving the load from switch A, from a switch cluster on, you know, switch pair A on the left to switch pair B on the right, you could be shifting a multi-gigabit I/O load to the storage array, and you could also be shifting a multi-gig load from the users. So if you think about a database server, say like a Microsoft SQL Server, which is CPU and memory intensive, and if it suddenly decides to vMotion from, perhaps not a very good use case, but it's valid, you need to vMotion that from the left-hand side of your data center to the right. So you're actually moving it off a chassis which is attached to one pair of switches over there to another chassis which is over there on another pair of switches. That memory image is going to sync across your backplane bandwidth, your core networking bandwidth, and then all of your I/O traffic is going to shift as well, because that I/O image is either going to be reading, writing to the storage array over iSCSI or NFS if you're using those, or it's going to be on fiber channel. So both chassis have to have enough bandwidth to do the read-write to the storage and have the same image presented to both chassis. And then you've also got the user data is going to transfer over in a split second. So you could suddenly have a multi-gig user load shifting from chassis A to chassis B. And before that actually happens, there's a burst of traffic while the memory sync actually happens. And if you're actually using IP storage, be it NFS or iSCSI or SIFS, then it's actually going to shift that load over there as well.
Well, Ivan, translate that back into what does all of that do for oversubscription models? And, you know, if you want to call it data center 3.0 or however you want to tag it, does that change anything from what we've been doing?
No.
Because to me, my gut is I tend to agree with what you're saying. No, I mean, it looks, there's kind of an assumption that if you have data that's got to pass through your core, there's an element of oversubscription there. You can't build enough bandwidth to handle every port in the data center speaking at full volume. You assume there's oversubscription, and I don't know that this changes things a lot, but...
Well, let's start from the beginning. There are two types of vMotion. One is within the VMware cluster, and usually those servers should be pretty close together. And I think currently the new limit will be 32 servers or something. So if these are like 4 UCS chassis, so this fits into 1 or 2 racks. And then you have vMotion between clusters, which you have to trigger manually. And before doing that, you should think and plan what will happen to the traffic across your network.
Now, a lot of that could be happening from, you know, you're talking about a common data center here, you know, where these clusters are right next to each other. So presumably these could be vMotioning between servers on the or between clusters sharing the same VLAN. And so therefore, may never actually hit your core. It could be going, let's say it's a UCS with a 5000 in it, you know, Nexus 5K to 5K.
Yeah, well, within the cluster, you should never hit the core. Yeah. Between the clusters, you might or you might not. But VMware or, well, vSphere will never do vMotion between clusters automatically. It is a manual action that someone has to trigger. So before doing that, you better know what you're doing.
Meaning the VMware system administrator better know what the implications are for the network before he hits that button and says move.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think this comes back to an old thing of sort of ensuring that your application people, and in this environment we could call VMware an application, are sort of aware of the relative cost of moving data around to different parts of the environment. So, you know, basically moving within a small area is cheaper to them or to the organization than moving, you know, across the data center or across to another data center. And it's kind of one of those kind of early discussions you need to have with people when you start to deploy this kind of stuff is to make them understand that the network isn't free, and the further you move, the more it's going to cost, especially when you're doing these big things that will sort of churn up the uplink cost, which is the expensive bit.
Somebody said that the latency, tolerable latency for vMotion was 50 ms. Was that VMware's guideline?
That was design guideline, yeah.
Yeah, and was that a WAN optimized 50 ms. or was that just 50 ms.?
That's their recommendation.
Yeah. I mean, so in theory, you could be moving a huge... I mean, 50 ms. gives you the ability to move across, a DS3 that's geographically pretty far away still, and you could still be under 50 ms.
The recommended distance between two data centers is 100 kilometers by VMware.
Okay, so that changes things then, too.
Ethan, you wouldn't want to move a VM to another data center.
Well, I'm playing off of what we were just saying, where you've got an administrator for a VMware cluster who might think that's a heck of an idea. He may do a ping to his cluster that's in some other data somewhere and say, I'm under 50 ms, do it. Hits the button. And now you've got 4 gigs of host he's trying to shovel over to a data center across a very slow link, and it's theoretically possible from what we've been saying. But I agree, yeah, no, you'd never really want to do that. But I bet someone does it.
Ethan, the other problem is that machine that's running on the other end, you've effectively moved the CPU and the memory, but it's still tethered to the firewall and the router and the storage in the original data center.
Yeah, but you can have storage vMotion as well, and certainly there are solutions that are out there to be able to do this across a wide area where the layer 2 address space has been flattened between the two data centers.
Oh, layer bridging between data centers is not an issue here. The problem is Greg wrote a great post yesterday or so, I think, about the traffic trombone. All the in and out traffic still goes through the first data center.
Mm-hmm.
And has to traverse the low-speed link between the data centers twice.
So if you figure the traffic comes in through the front end, then it's going to go over the layer 2 network to the other data center, and then that server is going to respond back to the original data center and send the traffic out the front end, unless you've got some technique for shifting the inbound traffic load.
Yeah, this is one of the challenges with F5 solution for this, where you can do a lot of this stuff. It came up in Tech Field Day in Seattle, and we talked about it on the show several weeks ago, where it's kind of neat where you can, your VMware management to move a host from one cluster to another in a different data center and use their magic tunnel that goes between these two load balancers. But then you have exactly that problem, where the user is still nailed up to the original data center, has to traverse the slow link and then get their data back via that slow link and so on. Sure, they've still got their connection up, but at a pretty high penalty, unless you've got something super high speed between the two data centers.
Exactly, in which case you don't care, yeah. Mm.
The other issue to think about here is also microburst loads, where you have transient loads which last, say, for 50 to 250 milliseconds, where you're trying to do traffic backwards and forwards. The sort of the hidden challenge of modern data centers is around a VMware synchronization bursts actually between machines. So 4 gigabytes of memory needs to sync, but there's these huge bursts of that traffic as it's transmitted between the two. And a short-term burst can actually overrun. So we were talking earlier about the QoS buffers on the 6500. You can easily overrun the input buffers on a 10-gig port or a 1-gig port for transient-based, 50 milliseconds or something like that, and traffic gets thrown away. Ethernet switches out there which have very deep buffering mechanisms, so you'll hear companies like Arista and Force10 talking about elastic buffering mechanisms which don't allow... So when a burst comes along that's a very short time duration, say for a transaction, a read-write transaction to a database, none of those packets are ever discarded, they're buffered. And that's a more efficient transmission mechanism across the database backbone than to ask the server to retransmit. It's much better to buffer. And VMware is very sensitive, but the storage industry is particularly sensitive to that because it's more important to not throw away a packet than it is to... buffering's better than throwing away a packet for storage read-writes. So we talked earlier about the loads generated by storage networks, and what most people are doing today is they're actually building a completely separate storage Ethernet network, and still storage over IP, but it's on a different Ethernet switching infrastructure from that that's used for IP data, because of the fear of IP microbursts coming in and causing buffer overruns. Because if you're trying to run your ordinary data as well as your storage data, the two can exceed. You know, you can get head of queue blocking into a switching fabric, or the virtual output queues on the output stage of a fabric switch can also cause, you know, choke points in the data infrastructure. I'm getting a bit deep here, but even with the depth of the conversation that we're covering here, there's a whole bunch of issues that go into a lot of detail.
Well, Steve, have you got any comments on oversubscription? I mean, have you been looking at some of the new traffic patterns that we're seeing in data centers with VMware and storage, and is it changing the way you're thinking about oversubscription and so on?
It is. I mean, because if you go just look at your general day-to-day loads, oversubscription is fine. But as mentioned, the V motion is really what's driving this, and so you really have to plan out what's the worst case scenario in some of these changes, and you really have to have a closer relationship with the server team, as you mentioned, so they don't just go, oh, vMotion it here and there. So they understand, you know, if there's a limitation, that they're aware of that. And that's been driving a lot of our conversations now between, you know, different data centers, what they want to do, because they want to do vMotion between data centers, not for some of the reasons that, you know, Greg mentioned in that blog post the other day, because they're aware of those issues, but they want to be able to move things around at will. And if we did an 8-to-1 oversubscription C7000 chassis, well, and if they're going to jump between two chassis, that's just never going to work. It's very important now to be at least aware and understand your traffic patterns.
One of the big challenges, as you've just mentioned there, Steve, is that the networking team needs to engage with the server people. The big problem I'm experiencing here, and there was actually a blog post this week from Kevin Bovis, who was in a podcast during the week, saying that we have to have communication skills, but we also need to keep up to date with our server skills. That doesn't mean that we actually have to be able to configure an Active Directory tree and, you know, extend a schema and all that sort of stuff. What it does mean is that we need to, as networking people, to be able to speak the language of server people for various things. To me, that means being able to sit down with the server people and know enough about this vMotion technology. You've just heard me go on a bit about some vMotion stuff, and not everybody's thought about or run into these sorts of things, you know, understanding the impacts of them. And I guess this might be a good time to mention that Ivan Pepelniak and myself will be getting together in San Jose on when are we getting together, Ivan?
The day before the Netfield day, so that's September 15th, I think.
So September 15th, Wednesday, September the 15th, Ivan and myself will be having a data center to cloud computing for the very first iOS Hints Live day in San Francisco. You'll be able to meet Ivan.
Sorry, Greg, San Jose.
San Jose?
It's San Jose.
San Jose?
Yeah, I made a typo. I fixed it already.
And we're going to be getting there. We're going to have a facility there where you can come and meet us and talk to us about designing data centers, what we're actually hoping you can do. And, of course, Ivan's the brains of this operation and I'll be the mouth. But we'll be sitting there and asking you to bring along your designs, and you can spend time talking to us and discussing designs and discussing technologies for that day. Join in the discussion and learn, you know, speak to us about things that you'd be interested in. Is there any particular topics you think that would be worth covering, Ivan, that people need to know about?
Well, Greg, the original idea, and you explained it very nicely, was that we can't cover the network designs remotely, because it's impossible to prepare things in advance, and there is no whiteboard that you could use in a WebEx environment or something. Well, there is one, but it's awkward. So I would hope that those people who want to participate would send in their designs or their issues or their challenges, and then I'll try to synthesize this into a few designs that would cover most of the cases. And then we'll go through them and explore various options and pros and cons.
Okay. And people can find out more about the event at the following URL. It's ioshintsdatacenter.com www.eventbrite.com, where you can check out the details for registering to join us at the very first ever iOS Hints Live 2010 in San Jose on September the 15th. We're going to run it from currently projecting from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and we'd love to look forward to meeting you there. Ethan says he's going to come along and throw popcorn down the aisle or something.
We'll see. It depends on when I get out there, because that's the day before Tech Field Day. So depending on how the travel goes, we'll see if I can make
it or not.
You're
most welcome. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we could turn it into a dig type event where we put all four. We'll crowd surf across the nerds. Yeah.
Greg, we have to keep semi-serious. There's some people paying for it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm only joking. I'll edit this bit out. Don't worry. So for customers who have – I talked a minute ago about the separate storage network, and perhaps I should explain a little bit about that. At this point in time, combining a storage and a data network – if you're running 6500 switches, is a little bit problematic because of the QoS problem. If you've got a storage networking team who are used to having their own switching infrastructure, which they did, it was called a fiber channel switch, then they'll probably be more comfortable with a separate storage infrastructure, separate switch infrastructure. I kind of support that view, because at least if it's on IP, then you can integrate it later on. And once you've actually got them on Ethernet and then running on IP storage, it's very simple to come up. But the 6500 platform, in my view, is perhaps not the most optimum for high-volume storage traffic, because the buffering mechanisms and the queuing and the backplane and the oversubscription could cause problems. However, if you're moving towards the Nexus 7000, at least theoretically, you can have modules in there which are not heavily oversubscribed. So the current generation of M-series modules, well, there's two types of modules that go into the 7000. There's an M-series and an F-series. The F-series modules are the fabric modules, and they're the high-speed layer 2 forwarding engines that have no layer 3 capability. And then there's an M-series of modules in the Nexus 7000 that do layer 3 functions. So for IP storage, you can actually use the blades in the 7000, which are the F-series, for high-speed layer 2, you know, lossless Ethernet performance. That's not fiber channel over Ethernet, that's just Ethernet over, you know, with IP, iSCSI, NFS. But for the data networks, you might want to connect all of your servers to an M-series or a mezzanine blade, which has a different thing. And so, but Dan raised a point in the show notes about the feature capabilities of the Nexus 7000, where not all the features that you want are in the 7000. So what features are missing, Dan?
It's a lot of the small things, which can be sort of...
What, like MPLS?
Well, sorry, MPLS is one of them. Yes, that's
that's a small thing, yes, I agree.
In a data center, you have to remember with the Nexus 7000, it is a data center switch. It's not a WAN switch. It's not a border edge switch. You know, it is meant to be in the data center. And there are some data centers that are sort of big enough and have the functionality requirements for MPLS. And yeah, you know, it's missing. And I gather from what I read in around the place that Cisco are in no hurry to add it. But the things like, for example, OSPF, so it does OSPF when you're using the layer 3 cards. But I was doing some work on traffic shifting this week, and things like the max metric command, which for those of you who are familiar with it, is a way of increasing the cost, basically, of a switch to cleanly push traffic off it so that you can take it out for maintenance. And there's a lot of tweaks and bells in the max metric. If you ever actually want to understand OSPF really and truly, go and learn the max metric command. Because if you understand it really, really well and actually understand what all the tweaks do, you will understand OSPF. But anyway, the tweaks and bells aren't there on the Nexus. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do in terms of traffic shifting, which are beautiful and clean on, for example, the 6500. But when you try and do it on a Nexus, the tweaks aren't there and it simply won't do it. So you have to get into really dirty solutions like going to every interface and raising the cost on them and crazy stuff like that, which you don't really want to do. You want a traffic shift to be a push-the-button operation that's done quickly and easily under pressure, potentially. And there's a lot of little things like that where they've got the basics in. They've got it will do OSPF, it will do EIGRP, it will do BGP. but it won't do it particularly well. Another good one, by the way, it won't take a full BGP table. And again, you know, it is a data center switch, and you could argue that maybe it shouldn't. But for something which is relatively new technology and relatively modern silicon, you would kind of imagine they'd put enough memory in the thing that it could take a BGP table.
You can only assume that there's new supervisors coming for it at some stage in the future. And in fact,
That's fine, but I mean, it is a relatively new one anyway. You know, it's not like this is the old model and there's the new one coming along. This is a pretty new bit of kit out there.
I think Cisco really wants to emphasize the layer 2 and the frame forwarding features of the Nexus.
But say, once you start getting into advanced layer 3 functions, they're not there.
Dan, the problem with BGP is very simple. It's not the problem of memory. It's the TCAM problem. TCAM, layer 3 TCAM has something like 56,000 entries. And you cannot have more IP prefixes than that.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah.
So the problem is that you simply can't forward to so many different destinations. And the reason for that is that TCAM is awfully expensive.
We probably should say for the listeners that TCAM is actually an electronic circuit that sits in the supervisor engine. It's not memory. It's not a memory algorithm. It's not a piece of software. It's physically a piece of silicon switching that transistors design and stuff like that, that is able to do the forwarding of the frames at wire speed. There's no other way to do it but to actually do it in silicon.
It's content addressable memory. You see, usually when you want to find something that's in the memory, you have to give the address of the memory cell. Whereas with CAM, you give the content of the cell. And then the right cell raises the hand that says, that's me, and gives you whatever is in there. So instead of searching for the, let's say, longest prefix to match, you just give the prefix to TCAM. And the right row raises the hand that says, that's me. This is how you need to forward it.
So it's radically different. It's not like memory inside a server is what I'm saying. It's not just a random access memory or a static RAM or some sort of DRAM technology. It's radically different to that.
And it's expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive because it has to be as fast as static RAM, which is expensive. Plus, it needs additional circuitry to match the content. Plus, it's not used widely. DRAM, for example, is cheap because everyone is using the same chipset, whereas TCAM is rarely used, so the production volume is not there.
So are we saying the Nexus platform, in the cards and soups that are currently available, does not have a whole lot of TCAM space, and therefore large BGP table loads are a challenge?
And as Greg said early on there, I mean, you have to an extent got to remember what this thing is. It's a data center switch. You know, from a layer 2 forwarding perspective, it's a fantastic bit of tin. But you have to sort of take it within those sort of limits. And, you know, harking back to the 6500, which isn't the best at any particular thing, you know, it does all of these things sort of reasonably well, which is, I think, kind of why a lot of the time you end up going back to the 6500 for these kind of tasks.
Now, Jeremy, on his blog, I mean, he had to step away because he has a life outside of podcasting, apparently. But on jeremyfelibin.com, he did a post on migrating from Catalyst to Nexus. He said one of the things missing from the Nexus platform is VTP. The VTP is unavailable. Does anyone besides Jeremy miss VTP?
No.
No.
Yes.
I wish he was here.
It has its uses.
Yes.
I'm
a huge believer in VTP. I think it enforces good practice around VLAN numbering. One of the problems is if people get to manually configure VLANs on a per switch, you suddenly find in the middle you've got trying to configure VLAN 2,556, and then you find that there's actually one over there, and there's one over there, and they're two different VLANs.
Mm-hmm.
VTP happen. Enforces that good practice. Now, to a large extent, the pain and the problems of VTP version 2, in terms of it being a security risk or an integrity risk to the integrity of the network, have been fixed in VTP version 3. And VTP version 3 also now includes support for VLANs. There's a post on my blog about what's in VTP v3 if you're interested. But I miss VTP in because it just makes it so simple. I can hand off VLAN creation tasks and configuration of port to server people and know that they can't flub it.
Steve, were you also saying yes back there?
I don't miss it. I think with some of the features of v3 that are finally making their way into iOS, it a lot of the problems that people have experienced with it over the years kind of go away. But I really won't miss it.
Another thing that Jeremy pointed out on the blog about that's different, it isn't a missing feature in the NAS, but something that's different that, Dan, you were talking about OSPF, and he mentioned that the OSPF default reference bandwidth is a 40 gig now rather than 100 meg, which will be a different thing for a lot of people that are used to seeing that.
Yeah, it's a lot more but obviously you have to be careful then when mixing and matching with other technology.
And you're going to have to do auto cost reference bandwidth statement on everybody else to match it up then?
One of the other interesting things about the Nexus 7000 is I recently did a podcast this week with from Doug Goulet from Arista Networks, who was pointing out that the design for the Nexus 7000 actually started 10 years ago. And Doug was at the time a part of Cisco and part of the design team when the Nexus started in 2001. And he makes an interesting point, is that a lot of the design decisions were made in light of what they were expected a long time ago. And I personally don't feel convinced that the Nexus 7000 is a revolutionary switch. If I look at other switch designs from other companies, and in the weeks to come, I'll be interviewing people like Force 10. And in a couple of weeks, I'll be off to the HP Tech Day on their networking equipment. And it will be interesting to see what their switching designs look like. But one of the biggest concerns I have with the Nexus 7000 is power consumption, which leads me to the view that the silicon inside it must be old or old designs. You know, is it 150 nanometer fabs because the chips were designed so long ago? I mean, do you guys think that the Nexus 7000 is future-proof?
No.
Oh, gosh, no.
I don't.
I mean, you're right on the power. I think it's something like 15 kilowatts to light up a Nexus 7K. It's a crazy amount of power. So, put a pair in, that's 30 kilowatts. But, you look at the actual the actual throughput. So we were talking about subscription things on the 6500s earlier and on the 4500s. So, when you're looking at things like, I think 80 gig on the, the layer 3 cards, you think, well, it's not that amazing. So, I mean, if you're putting a 10 gig card in, that's eight slots. Okay, that's okay. When you go to 40 gig, you're only talking about two slots per card, assuming you want it to be non-blocking. Don't get me wrong, it's good. It's better than a 6500. But for the amount of power and the amount of money you're going to spend on one of these things or a pair of these things, it's not that huge of a performance jump.
The amount of space the thing takes up in a rack, too. I mean, it's a very tall and deep. This day and age, a follow-up to what you were saying, an 80 gig, yeah, it's good. Is it mind-blowing, staggering, really just, wow, I got to have one now because of all this extraordinary throughput? Yeah, not so much.
It kind of makes you wonder with why they limited it to 80 gig, because if you look at a lot of the materials, they talk about future-proofing, they talk about with the five fabrics, I think it's like 256 gig per slot. Why they didn't take advantage of that right away? Was that an intentional holdback, or is there some other reason that they're having problems really getting that theoretical 256 gig per slot?
How far away are we from the second generation cards? I mean, I've been hearing about those since we bought the first gen cards. Have they actually spec second gen cards for the Nexus yet? I don't think you can buy them, as far as I know.
No.
And haven't heard anything about when I'm going to be able to.
If you're buying this for performance, you kind of have to think, well, am I going to buy this, spend this huge amount of money, because they're very expensive, for a small increase over the 6500. Now, okay, you've got a lot more line cards as well. You've got the 18 line cards or something, as opposed to 9 minus supervisor. You've kind of got to be thinking there's something coming down the line, either an improvement in Nexus or someone else like Juniper will turn around and say, hey, guys, we've got one that goes at 160 or 320 or whatever. And for the amount of money you're spending on these things, you're going to be stuck with it for a good few years. And you could actually find yourself being behind the curve quite quickly while you're waiting for this thing to pay for itself.
I know there's more I think there's more technology. I've got an idea the maximum capacity of a Nexus 7000 is like the backplane performance is 1.3 terabits a second. But the question is, when's that coming? And I would have expected to see second-generation supervisors and second-generation line cards about now.
Instead, the discussion we're having is feature parity in NXOS and things that aren't there.
That's right. OTV is late. I was originally promised the OTV features in the Nexus 7000 in 6 months ago in first ship, and now it's only just shipped in May, June timeframe. And, of course, it won't be stable in the code train for at least another 6 months to a year, which from my view is very late. I want to jump back to something that you were talking about before, which is in terms of routing. Of course, the Nexus 7000 is intended to be a data center core, so it's more focused on frames and flat-out forwarding performance. If you do want to route and hold BGP tables, you should look at the ASR range. I was looking at the ASR 9000 this week. And even there's a 13-slot version of the ASR router, which is highly optimized for Enterprise Edge, and 6 and 9 slots. And those things have got staggering forwarding performances.
Well, yeah, they cost them. Don't they cost an equally staggering amount of money? I say that just because I put in some 1004s license with the software high availability and paid an amazing amount of money for what those things can do. Not a lot of port density, a lot of packet forwarding. And you say a 13-slot ASA, what's that going to cost?
Yeah, not cheap, but it does work. You know, the Nexus 7000 isn't as cheap. Of course, you've hit on the weakness in Cisco's product lineup is that the price of the products is usually very high. To me, it's not even actually the purchase price of the Cisco equipment, it's the maintenance price. Currently, we're paying, you know, the general sort of 8x5x4 NBD maintenance on a Cisco is 15% of list for a Cisco and 10% of list for an OEM service. That means over 3 to 5 years, you'll pay as much for maintenance as you did on actually purchasing the product. And still a concern for me is the overpricing of maintenance and of course, the overpricing of the product. But while Cisco's dominant in the marketplace, it's going to continue.
That for our case, we've kind of held off on some of the Nexus, really looking at it. We've started looking at other products such as Zego, which is a little bit different. It's not going to be your core switching. You have to connect to it. But for server-to-server switching in the data center, there's some other companies that are doing some really exciting things that make a lot more sense for where the data center is going. And Juniper, they've been talking about what they're going to do in the data center for quite a while, but not really released anything. So I don't know where they're going with that. But with the Zego, it uses InfiniBand, and it provides some really high performance, low latency stuff between the servers.
Well, you can get quad data rate InfiniBand running up to 120 gigabits per second.
The Zego hasn't released the quad; they only have the double. Yep. But I mean, today. I mean, you use 20 gig today and with a much lower latency than what you would get on anything else.
And they're really positioning that for the data center, Steve. I mean, because when you say InfiniBand, the first thing that comes to my mind is, oh, that's for specialized HPC clusters that are in some academic research facility where they make, quantum mechanics, paint rainbows or something extraordinary. And I don't really think of it as a data center sort of a technology, you know.
Yeah, and that's what they're doing. They're really tagging along with VMware real heavy. But what they do is you put a InfiniBand, well, two, but you put an InfiniBand card in the server that on that InfiniBand card, you can present through the Zego a 10 gig Ethernet, fiber channel, you know, whatever you want, multiple of those. And then you can carve that up however you want it with some QoS on the Zego. And so you don't have to worry about, oh, I have a fiber channel this or, because we're talking about the C7000s. You could, in the back of those, have two Ethernet switches, two fiber channel switches with a whole bunch of cables coming out. Where with this, you just would have a single InfiniBand pass-through on the back of those that would go to the Zego, and you'd have 20 or 40 gig to every single server that can be fiber channel or Ethernet, and it runs at a much lower latency. When you talk about vMotion, just the speed which those could vMotion between chassis is pretty impressive.
Mm. I actually visited SIGO in San Jose about a year ago as part of the first Gestalt ID Tech Field Day, and we actually went to their offices and saw the technology. And it's so just to add on to what Steve said there is that that's actually a top-of-rack solution today. So what you do is you have a server, you put an InfiniBand card into it, and then it runs to an InfiniBand switch at the top of the rack. And most people would then connect Ethernet to that InfiniBand switch and fiber channel. So in the same way that a Nexus 5000 is used for the Cisco UCS strategy, so you have the UCS servers and then they have a 10 gig going up to a UCS 6100, which acts as a top-of-rack concentrator for their products. And then out of the UCS 6100, you run fiber channel and Ethernet. Or you might choose to run the UCS 6100 into a Nexus 5000. The InfiniBand works conceptually the same, and that is that you have the server going to the top of the rack with an InfiniBand, which is a 20 gigabit dual data rate, or you can go to a 40 gigabit, and then out the front of that you might have fiber channel and Ethernet going on. So then you can have a rack of equipment, all InfiniBand connected, with 20 gig interfaces, dual 20 gigs for every server, with latencies that are one quarter that of Ethernet packets, because Ethernet is relatively high overhead. InfiniBand was optimized for that from day one. I'm really pleased to see that you're looking at the SIGO solution, because I was very impressed by it, and also the management tools for it. That GUI console to drive the SIGO switch is pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty simple to use, and it really makes sense. It's one of these things, as we talk about the converging of data centers, like if you're going to have a solution like this, you again have to work really close with your server team. So if you have very divided departments, a solution like that's going to be kind of hard, because both teams really need to have access to it, and for multiple reasons.
Okay, everybody. Well, thank you very much. And that's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us again this week. Ivan, thanks very much for coming on the show. Tell us about yourself and what you're going to be doing.
So the next few days, I'll be finishing the material for the data center webcast. Then I have a few consulting jobs, and then we'll probably meet in San Jose.
And where can people find you?
blog.ioshints.info is a great starting point. Or if you really want to listen to my ramblings on Twitter, it's at ioshints.
And don't forget that Ivan and myself will be in San Jose doing data center designs. I encourage you to come along and talk to us about designing your own data center. Of course, I'd like to thank Dan Hughes for coming in this week. I'm so glad you could make it. I know you weren't here at the beginning, but tell us what you're doing this week, Dan.
I'm basically trying to turn up some data center capacity right now, so that's keeping me pretty busy. But you can, if I get any brief interludes in it, I will be blogging on blog.aloran.co.uk, or you can follow me on Twitter at rovingengineer.
Thank you, Dan. And Steve Rosen, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell us what you're doing this week.
Well, this week I'm finishing up. We mentioned the Zego. We're doing a demo, and we're wrapping that up this week. And if you'd like to follow me, the easiest way to do that is on Twitter, just simple at Steve. It's the best way to do it.
Hey, thanks a lot. Ethan?
Hey, I'll be finishing up a 6500 build. And you know, I got such a long list of old equipment to be replacing with new that I'm starting to actually lose track of it until someone pings me and goes, hey, when are we going to have this installed? And I go, oh, yeah. You can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks, or I'll blog at packetattack.word.com and a bunch of other places. But if you go to Packet Attack, I got links to all the other places, because I can't seem to stop writing. It is an addiction.
I do have one anecdote to tell you, Ethan, that you'll enjoy, is that I was chatting to one of our engineers today. We were reviewing a part of a design, and there was a switch in the core of our network which hasn't been rebooted for 5.5 years.
Beautiful.
Don't touch it.
Oh. Yes, that was the fear. It's a router.
Yeah, somebody came to me yesterday. He brought me a Snickers bar because he was worried that my diva level was going to go very high. He was recabling something in a rack, accidentally knocked the power out of a switch and plugged it back in, and it was done. So he was bringing me the Snickers bar by way of apology for killing the switch. This thing is a 2900XL that's so old. I mean, it's got the letters worn off the front. That's how long the thing's been around. I was actually glad.
I haven't seen a 2900XL in a long time.
Oh, it's just an old ILO switch.
There you go.
That's now dead.
Yeah. And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter at etherealmind. We'd love to hear your feedback about the show, so please send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. We do answer, we do reply, and we do want to hear what you're thinking. You can also check out the podcast website at http://packetpushers.net to leave comments on the show. Or follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. And remember, too much networking would never...